Hi, I'm Dr. Stan Steindl. Welcome to Compassion in a T-shirt. I just wanted to let you know that I've recently set up my Substack. It's only in its infancy, but please check it out. I'll put the link in the description below. Dr. Aaron Frost is an Australian-based clinical psychologist who specializes in improving psychotherapy outcomes for clients. Aaron is co-author of the book Creating Impact, the Four Pillars of Private Psychology Practice, which is a must-read for those working hard in private practice to be helpful and to get good outcomes for their clients. Aaron also has a particular interest in clinical supervision and runs workshops and masterclasses on how to be an effective supervisor and to be helpful for early career psychologists. He and I travelled to Chicago together many years ago to do the feedback-informed treatment training with Dr. Scott Miller. Aaron has truly become the master of how we can be most helpful in therapy. And being helpful, of course, is at the heart of compassion. And so I bring you Dr. Aaron Frost. Well, Dr. Aaron Frost, welcome to Compassion in a T-shirt.
Thanks for having me. It's a huge, huge pleasure to catch up with you as always.
As always, yes. I was very much looking forward to our conversation. The book you co-authored is called Creating Impact, the Four Pillars of Private Psychology Practice. Can you just give us a bit of a sense of the book as a whole, maybe, but also a sort of an executive summary of these four pillars, if you wouldn't mind. Oh, look,
fantastic. So this was a book that was kind of conceived during lockdown, and it really is a group effort. So I don't want to take too much credit for it. I would hand over a lot of credit for that for Kay Frankham as well as the other authors. But the thing that I guess I've always been really interested in quality in terms of both doing training well, doing therapy well, doing business well. And I've always been struck by the fact that a lot of people see almost like a false dichotomy between you either run a really good practice or a financially successful practice. And this idea that you become financially successful by skipping corners and by, you know, screwing over the clinicians, screwing over the clients, doing things as cheaply and nastily as possible. And the thing that really brought all of us authors together was the idea that actually it's a synergy. That actually when you treat your clients well, when you treat your clinicians well, the business and the financials kind of flow well from that. So we've kind of broken that up to the best that we can into this kind of four model idea that there are client factors, there are therapist factors, there's practice-based factors like clinical governance and risk management, and then there's actual financials. And you've got to look after the financials in order to have the money to look after the clinicians. You've got to look after the clinicians in order to look after the clients. And if you look after the clients, then the business side of things will look after itself. So it's a real, we talk about the idea of a virtuous cycle, that when you keep all of those four factors in mind and you look after all of those factors appropriately, that's the heart of quality rather than what's the most profitable practice or what's got the best retention rates or what's got the best whatever. You actually have to balance all four.
Actually, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I hadn't kind of quite put that together, but there is each of them sort of feed off each other, and there is a kind of a virtuous cycle.
And that's the heart of the book. So the book kind of is broken into sort of those four sections, as well as a bit of introductory material and some expanded material, but just our thoughts, our ideas, as well as our experiences, the things that have, you know, worked for us in our, both our practice journeys, as well as, you know, for some of the authors, their individual journeys, either as practitioners or as supervisors, and trying to pull that collective wisdom together for hopefully the benefit of other people.
So those four factors, those chapters, you're referring to them as pillars. Is that kind of a thing that I got right there?
Yeah, I think we think of them as pillars. And I mean, pick your metaphor, four really essential things that are required to hold up some other thing. Maybe they're table legs, maybe they're four suits of cards, like whatever works for you as a metaphor. We went with pillars because, you know, obviously our drawing skills are not spectacular, and it's easier to draw pillars with a Nice little structure on top of it. But yeah, the
Yeah.
idea of really essential ingredients, maybe ingredients, the four essential ingredients.
I think I like pillars, actually. I'm going to stick with that. It reminds me of some sort of ancient Greek mythology or something. I don't know particularly why. Doric columns. Maybe it could have been the four Doric columns.
You don't think the four ingredient cake mix? Here's the egg, here's the flour, here's your fruit, here's your
Yes.
cake have
Yeah.
other things, I'm sure,
Yeah. Yes.
but
Well, let's stick with the first pillar to begin with. The client, I suppose. And one of the bits there is to do with routine outcome measurement. So, what is routine outcome measurement? How does it work? Why might it be an important or essential ingredient?
Yeah, look, great. Look, as a starting point, routine outcome measurement really has, it's got a lot of names at the moment, whether we call it measurement-based care, routine outcome measurement, feedback-informed therapy, client-directed outcome-informed, they're all just different flavors of the same thing. Effectively, that in some ways it's a very modern approach, in other ways it's quite old school. It's the idea of N equals one. Every client is an individual experiment. Your conceptualization or formulation is simply your hypothesis. It's not a truth. And then your treatment is a way of testing your hypothesis. So if you believe that a person is depressed because they have a series of cognitive distortions, that's a theory. It's a testable theory because if you can get them to change those cognitive distortions, then theoretically their depression should get better. And if that doesn't happen, then that's not the client's fault. That's your fault. That says that you need to go back to the drawing board and look at your theory. So, routine outcome measurement is really just a way of systematizing that. In a lot of us do pre-post. We'll, give a DAS at the beginning, give a DAS at the end. The problem is that's useless. That just tells us whether therapy worked or not. Routine outcome measurement tells us whether it is working. So then, if it's not working, it gives you an opportunity to change directions earlier. Because if you're doing ACT with somebody and they've had five sessions of ACT and it hasn't worked, there's a pretty good chance that the sixth session or the seventh session is not going to suddenly change the trajectory. So it just kind of keeps everyone a little bit accountable at that client level. When we start thinking about the therapist factor, we can then take all of that data and we can measure my effectiveness. So we can see whether I'm getting better year on year. And we can also look at whether an entire practice has got good outcomes and how that performs compared to other practices. So that's the heart of routine outcome measurement at that client level, but also overall at the career of the therapist level, but also the practice level. And the data tells us we get better outcomes when we do it, with a significant reduction in dropout rates, as well as an improvement in overall therapy effect sizes.
So the routine outcome measurement that we're talking about here is really kind of giving clients regular measures of their kind of progress, their psychological distress or well-being. How do you sort of literally do it, or how do you kind of recommend, I suppose, that it might
Yeah.
be done?
Look, there's no magic in the measure that you choose, but you have to choose a measure. And I would probably recommend that you choose something that's brief, freely available, and able to be, integrated within your software, or you've got software available to do it. And it gives you enough information to have that sensitivity to change. Obviously, for some of the listeners here, they would know that myself and Kim Halford, our contribution here is the use of the DAS-10, which is specifically designed as a free measure that's out there that can be incorporated and used in whatever particular model or framework that you like. But there's dozens of others. I'm agnostic on the measure. I just wanted a measure to be out there and free and in the public domain. So that's our kind of contribution there. But again, there are others there, and I wouldn't say you're doing it wrong by using a different measure.
So just administering the DAS-10 kind of every session, tracking it along the way, and discovering or sort of gradually learning whether our hypothesized kind of our formulation and our hypothesized treatment is working, I guess, is how that all
Absolutely.
works.
And I really like the second and third piece of what you said there, because a lot of people do the tracking. Not so many people do the actually, let's test whether your hypothesis is correct, and then let's analyze the data and use it thoughtfully. Because again, it's one of those virtuous cycles. If we just collect the data and throw it into, the Skynet matrix, and the data is never seen again, no one is helped by that. That's just an administrative exercise. It's interesting, but it's largely pointless. If we take that data and we use it to improve the quality of clinical care, that's where the magic happens.
I guess there's something then in the conversation with the client themselves about it. Do we get those results kind of prior to going into session, or is it, how does that bit work?
So typically what is recommended, and I think there's kind of two preferred ways to do this. One is to give it to clients right before the session, and the other is to give it to clients in the session at the beginning. I think either of those is acceptable, but I think the key thing is what happens next, which is that you have to have a conversation about it. Hey, it looks like you're better between last session and this session. What are the things that you did that you think might have been associated with that? Or hey, it looks like you haven't made any change from last session to this session. Were you able to put the things in place that we talked about last time? Did they help? Did they not help? Because then, me as a clinician, I'm not going to go and recommend that they try something again that they've already tried and didn't work. Similarly, if I recommended something and they hit significant barriers in doing that, then it might be a conversation that we have about what those barriers are and what they need to do to overcome those barriers.
When you and I did the fit training with Scott Miller, there was a sense of no change after six sessions might mean referring on or doing something, to kind of to respond to that sort of a result. What's the current thinking around, when
That's a
one persists versus when one might suggest a change in therapist?
yeah, look, that's a really interesting point. And I've got to say, I've never been a huge fan of that quite algorithmic thinking. And I would never use an outcome measure to replace either client preference or clinician judgment. I think the outcome measures serve client preference and clinician judgment. It doesn't go the other way around. Having said that, there absolutely has to be some degree of accountability that therapy doesn't work for everyone. And also, therapy with Aaron Frost doesn't work with everyone, and therapy with Stan Steindl doesn't work with everyone. So that, to me, it's about being open to the fact that therapy doesn't always work, and that the data can help you to identify when it's not working. As for the idea of six sessions being a magical cutoff, I would definitely say three or four sessions is a reasonable point to be asking whether this type of therapy is working. And if there's no progress, then I think we need to be thinking about what's the reason for that. And the reason might be, hey, this client is really slow to build trust, and it's going to take a long time before they even tell you the real problem. But we can't then generalize that to all of our clients who are not progressing. We can't just say, well, all of my clients have complex trauma, and I can expect to see no progress there, because people with complex trauma do get better and they do make progress. And actually, that should be the expectation from therapy. So, yeah, I don't think six is a magic number, but I think you always need to be open to the null hypothesis that either therapy or therapy with you is not a contributor to this person's change story.
Yes, and I suppose it brings us to the next little piece of feedback, isn't it? Which is, well, firstly, we have feedback about the outcome and how the person's progressing along the way, and is our kind of treatment plan working? But then we have the kind of session feedback where the client gets a chance to give us some more direct feedback about kind of how we're going, and so tell us a bit about that aspect of the client pillar, getting feedback on the sessions.
I love that so much, because it's so humbling as a clinician when you go in, you take your absolute best swing at what you think the client needs and wants from a session, and then you get to the end and you ask them, did we talk about what you wanted to talk about? Do you feel heard and understood? Was this beneficial? And the answer that you get is nut, nut, and nut. And I mean, on the one hand, that should be embarrassing, but I never feel embarrassed by that. I always just feel like humans are incredibly complicated. We're not all spectacular at always communicating what our needs are. We as therapists are also not Jedis, and we are not, mind reading in any way, shape, or form. We just go on the information that comes from our clients. So to me, the number of times you ask that question and you get it wrong just constantly keeps me open to the idea that if I wasn't asking that question, I would just be blindly getting it wrong with my clients half of the time without having any kind of feedback. So yeah, I love that conversation. I love that piece. And even the, I won't ask you for your vintage, but me as a 25-year plus practitioner, I still get it wrong on a, on a pretty regular basis. And I find that really humbling to get that feedback from my clients.
Yeah, totally. So we get the sort of the progress on an outcome point of view, and then we get some direct feedback about how we're doing in terms of, I guess, our skills and
Absolutely.
so on. And on the basis of both of those, we get to move to pillar two, which is the therapist themselves. I know you're particularly fascinated in the whole concept of deliberate practice. You know, that's one of your
Yeah, absolutely.
Big areas of interest. And I guess could you tell us about deliberate practice kind of generally, or where it exists,
Yeah, sure.
in other areas perhaps, but also what is that exactly for therapists?
Look, it's a really great question. So let me go in the other direction. Rather than telling you about places where deliberate practice exists, let me tell you about places that it doesn't exist.
Okay.
Psychotherapy. That's the only
Okay.
one.
That's the only one.
Every other field of human knowledge, endeavor, sport, music, surgery, law, et cetera, people use deliberate practice. I'll give an example. And this was so beautiful, and it was just such a neat little moment. I was at my kid's basketball coaching session. She goes in at 6:30 in the morning. She's only little, but she goes in at 6:30 in the morning. They spend an hour and a half. They do a coaching session. And I watch the coach, and the coach is just spectacular. She's got two girls running in, and halfway through, they're kind of, one's attacking on the wing, one's in the center. And the exercise is she's got to come down the wing and then pass to the girl in the center, and the girl in the center has to do a layup. And the coach, before they've got 5 steps, she blows a whistle and she's like, No, you've got to be bouncing on your right hand, not your left hand, because you can't possibly pass it left from your left hand. You've got to have it in your right hand. So try again, do it in your right hand. They do the exercise again. The girl bounces it in the right hand. This time she throws it to the girl where she is rather than 2 steps ahead of her because, they're making pace. They blow it up again. This time the exercise works properly. She's got it in her right hand. She passes it with her right hand to the girl in the center. Passes it just in front of her. She takes the pass on her chest. She does the layup and it's perfect. Deliberate practice is literally just that process of taking a thing, a skill performance, a practice, identifying where it could be done better, and then in tiny iterative little steps, improving it. Often, deliberate practice is error-based, which often feels quite threatening for us, but none of those girls felt criticized that, they were being told they were terrible at basketball. The feedback is a gift. The coach is helping them win the next game by giving them the tip on how to score better. So, yeah, deliberate practice is simply the process of how do you get from being capable of doing a thing to being good at doing a thing? And it really is a case of breaking the thing down to its smallest possible components and then drilling an improved version of those components. And it's something I actually saw. You demonstrated spectacularly about a decade ago in one of your motivational interviewing workshops. Rather than, and I was in the audience there, and rather than you teaching us motivational interviewing, you broke down motivational interviewing into one of its core components was actually just listening and reflecting. And I can't remember exactly what the exercise was, but it was just 45 seconds of listen to what the person said and reflect it back, and then ask the person whether you got it right. And tell me if I've completely misremembered that. But just the power of seeing something very complex broken down into something very small, and then giving people an opportunity to kind of iteratively improve that thing. That to me is what deliberate practice is and the power that it offers for us as clinicians. But unfortunately, we often get too excited by learning the new technique or the new model or the new whatever, whereas actually we need to learn how to do the technique. It's about us and our skill level, not about how many Scrabble letters we've got after our name in terms of the different techniques and models that we've gathered.
Yes, I was just thinking that as therapists, we often spend a lot of time and money going to a workshop and learning a new thing, a new tech, maybe a new technique or a new approach, and we're very kind of interested and often inspired by that, by workshops,
Absolutely.
and you know it's good, and also we get to see people and we hang out at morning tea, and
The
so the
coffee's sometimes
workshops.
all right.
Sometimes the copy's okay, and we you know, so there's all of that, but there seems to some yeah sometimes there's much less of the put the ball in your right hand, be ready to pass it to the left, you know, pass it just in front of the person. I mean, what would you say is the kind of the equivalent thing there, like if someone was really trying to get better, you know, what would be some of those kind of analogous steps for a therapist?
I honestly think the starting point is a taxonomy. Rather than thinking about I'm doing therapy or even I'm doing CBT, you've got to break it down to simple things. I'm working on listening to people. I'm working on responding empathically. I'm working on instilling hope. I'm working on creating structure. I'm working on setting homework. I'm working on setting a frame for therapy. There's 100 different, maybe not 100, but there are dozens upon dozens of individual skills within therapy. And I guess I'd give a shout out to my colleague and friend Daryl Chow, who developed the taxonomy of deliberate practice, which I think is at least briefly included in the book there, but it's also available for free online. The taxonomy of deliberate practice in psychotherapy really does take psychotherapy and in an a-theoretical and a-model way, just breaks it down to what those essential ingredients are.
Yes, we really need to be able to get to the end of a session or to the end of a week and kind of identify out of a taxonomy like that, what's the bit that I'm gonna take into the nets, I suppose, or you know, like the golfer who needs to go in and practice their short game or something out of the practice sand trap. You know, like how do we? I'll try to include a link, I think, to Daryl's
Yeah,
taxonomy of
that's a
deliberate
great idea.
practice.
Link
Yeah,
down below.
link down below
Smash the bell.
because that's excellent, isn't it? You know, like if we can be working on empathy and trying to work on an empathic stance as well as the actual skills that go along with that, you know, that then we're starting to really kind of improve.
Well, absolutely. And even the actual skills, like I think it's one of the reasons that CBT and prolonged exposure and, you know, all of these other kind of older techniques at the moment get such a bad name is that they're not being taught. You look at an ABC diagram and, you know, okay, there's an ABC diagram, there's a list of cognitive distortions, here's a downward arrow, go for it. Without any kind of, you know, structure in the what is the process? How does that work? How do you introduce that ABC model? How do you introduce that in a way that actually listens to the client's experience and weaves their experience into the model rather than just jumping up at a whiteboard and lecturing clients about how their thoughts are wrong? There are skillful ways to use the oldest school techniques, and there are unskillful ways to use the most modern and contemporary techniques. And the research is pretty clear that the technique you're using is not as important as your actual skill level. So, yeah, I'm a big fan of the use of deliberate practice on that clinician factor, working on ourselves.
So we've got the client and the therapist pillars, I guess, and you can definitely see the sort of the reciprocal kind of nature of things there, you know,
Absolutely.
getting feedback on outcome and on sessions, and then in a deliberate practice kind of way, taking that on board and trying to, well, both meet that individual client's need, I guess, but also build our skills more generally to apply to others. Pillars three and four are kind of practice and business. I suppose the bit that caught my eye there was client retention. You did allude to that actually earlier, but so can you speak some more about perhaps increasing retention, reducing dropout, how that might be important and how that factors into to your four pillars?
Dropout is such an interesting one in that it affects right across the board. So if we think about the financial impact of dropout, it costs practices a fortune in terms of lost revenue, in terms of the harm to their reputation, in terms of how much money and effort they spend on marketing, attracting new people. If you look at the client impact of dropout, the point at which a client decides my problem is serious enough that I want to take that vulnerable step and I want to put myself on a psychologist's couch and talk to them about it, it's just such a lost opportunity if that moment is completely squandered. And this might sound like an overly humanistic kind of thing, but I always just have in my head that behind every client, there's a sister or a dad or a best friend who's been talking to that person for months about how you need to get some help. And they are hoping that what's going to come out of this hour, this magical hour, is somehow going to make the life of the person that they love and by extension their own life a little bit better too. So from a client factor, dropout is a huge tragedy. And then from a clinician factor, the number of clinicians who, when I look at my supervisees, dropout and burnout are so closely associated with each other for a couple of reasons. One is just the workload attached with dropout. If you imagine yourself as a new registrar, you come in, you're prepared for that first session, you've seen on the GP referral that they've got bipolar, you've gone away, you've read up all about bipolar, you've got a session plan, you're ready to go. You put all of that work in, then you write a letter back to the GP, you put all of that work in, and then that person never comes again. And now in their place there's a person with anorexia. And now you've got to go away and do all of that work and all of that whole process again. You never get into the, I wouldn't say the easy part of therapy, but at least the less work intensive part of therapy of actually working along with the person. So definitely clinicians who have a high dropout rate often feel they can never get on top of their paperwork. They're just constantly swamped with preparation and note taking and letters. The second part of why dropout is problematic for clinicians and leads to burnout is it's really dispiriting. We're, at least for the most part, very few of us are here because we thought it'd be a good financial gig. Most of us are here because we thought we'd like to help people in some way, shape, or form. And when you just have this series of transitory therapeutic interactions that are never associated with much change, that's really disheartening for the therapist as well. So dropout for me is a really great example of how get your dropout rate sorted out. That's good for business, it's good for the client, it's good for the clinician. That is one of those real touch points of that virtuous cycle.
Yes, that relationship between client dropout and clinician burnout, I hadn't thought about that, but it seems yes, I can kind of really kind of sense that relationship and how difficult it is to do the work of the new client and for them to not come back, but also
Oh, absolutely.
to very rarely get the fifth or sixth or tenth session kind of moment where the client says, "This is really helping, thank you," or whatever,
I'm
because
feeling
those.
better. I'm talking to my mom in a way I never have before. I'm doing things at work I never have before. I'm going out in a way I never have before. Those are really good for our psyche as well. I think they're nourishing for us as practitioners, and certainly the absence of those is the opposite.
I remember consulting with you some time ago and asking how to define dropout, and you said less than three sessions. And I think I said something like, "So is a third session a dropout?" For some reason, I just couldn't. And you were like, "Well, two or less." And I was like, "Oh, okay, righto." But yeah, so that's kind of how you see it, I think, isn't it? Is sort of one or two sessions, and then another third session is or more is not booked.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think a really good definition of dropout is less than three sessions. So when they attend the third session, they are not a dropout anymore. And like any clinical indicator, you're going to get false positives and false negatives. People always get upset with this, and they're like, "Oh, but I do brief therapy, and I have people who come along for this, that, and the other." You will absolutely get false positives and negatives. Having said that, I've never seen anyone with a dropout rate of less than 5%. And I think that it's not about eliminating the false positives and false negatives. It's about knowing what a real benchmark is. And average clinicians have a dropout rate of 25 to 30%. Good clinicians have a dropout rate in the teens. I hesitate to use the word poor clinicians, but I'm just going to say poor clinicians for sake of communication efficiency. Often have dropout rates in the 60s and 70s. And that's problematic. So I think helping those clinicians, rather than looking at that as something that where we need to be punitive and need to be punishing those clinicians, actually dropout from a deliberate practice point of view, dropout is one of the simplest problems to solve. Show me a first session on video and I'll tell you why your clients are dropping out. It doesn't take a lot of expertise and it's really easy to fix. So I think identifying clinicians who've got high dropout rates and then doing the work with them, watching their videos and helping them come up with typically better ways to start sessions or better ways to end sessions.
Yeah, that really is the one of the basketball coaching kind of scenarios, isn't it? Is being able to watch first session videos or audios, but yeah, being able to maybe pick up on the little nuances of what happens there and how to perhaps, correct it.
It's such a tiny thing, like, but I remember looking at a video a couple of months ago of one of my registrars. And the session was great. She introduced it well, she set up a structure, she listened, she was empathic, she was warm. I thought she was doing a great job. And I'm like, why does this person have a dropout problem? And then I got to like the final 30 seconds and she kind of looked at a clock and she's like, "Well, we're just about done. I'll see you next week, shall we?" And that was it. That was the close of the session. And if it just had have been, "All right, we're just about out of time. We've got a bunch of things that are still really important to talk about. I can see that you've got an appointment next week. Should we pick them up there?" It's just that slight change, that slight coming up with a different way of doing things. Whereas the client walked with a, "I guess maybe I'll see you next week. Why would that be good for me? What will be the advantage of doing that?" And I think just changing that can be incredibly powerful.
And I guess it also the power of the session rating or the session feedback too, having that little moment at the end of the session where you ask the client, how was that for you, sort of a thing, and get a little bit of feedback. And if they give you something that perhaps you can work on, committing to work on it, next time we meet. So, okay, so I mean, as you know, this channel is kind of focused a little bit on compassion.
Sure.
And the reason I really wanted to chat with you is because obviously for therapists, there's a very fundamental compassionate motivation that we have, that we're trying to be helpful, I guess, is the
Yeah.
basics of it. And trying to be helpful means being able to kind of get this feedback and practice the skills and that sort of thing. I remember Paul Gilbert telling us, the story of the person walking along the beach or something, and suddenly out the back they see a sort of a swimmer who's struggling and kind of looks like they're really needing help, and so the person whips off their clothes and dives into the water and thinks, "Oh no, I can't actually swim," sort of a thing. And so we can have a sort of a compassionate motivation, but then the next bit is to really cultivate the skills to be helpful. So, what do you think about that, or how does that fit in sort of the work of psychotherapy and some of your effectiveness research, maybe from the therapist or the client's point of view?
This is such a great point, and it really, I guess the thing that pops into my head when you say that is around the issue of ineffective therapy. So we know that in the real world, 40 to 50% of people are not going to experience clinically significant change over the course of therapy. We also know, and I think this is the really important statistic that always just kind of sits really strongly in my head. Of those people who are not getting a good outcome, 20% of them will continue with therapy indefinitely. And I think that, to me, that's the compassion failure, because for the clinician, and I'll use cognitive language here. We often have cognitive distortions around not wanting to abandon people, not wanting to let them down, not wanting to, not rescue them, not do the thing. We want to be the swimmer who's out there helping the person. But if we can't swim, or at least we can't swim for that person, we're not really helping them. And again, if we think about that ineffective therapy, both from the client point of view as well as the therapist point of view, from the client point of view, actually, maybe a more appropriate way of thinking about the issue is not that you are abandoning a client, but failure to refer them on is actually you standing in the way of them getting more effective therapy from someone else. Because there actually isn't a correlation between someone having a poor therapy outcome and then having a second poor therapy outcome. Often people, for whatever reason, they don't gel with one therapist. The techniques that the therapist is using don't feel right for them. The personality of the therapist doesn't feel right. Then they go and see a second therapist, and it just they hit it out of the park together. So I think we need to kind of change that thinking for ourselves to move away from this idea of rescuing everybody to actually rescuing the people who we're good at rescuing. So I think that's the compassionate side for the client, actually for the therapist themselves. And this is the other really big burnout flag for me. If you think about a typical therapist in a typical year, maybe they're going to see 100 clients. Let's say they're going to get a good outcome with 50, 60 of those clients. Let's say 40 of them are not going to get a good outcome. If 20% of that 40 are going to stick around indefinitely, that's 10 clients who are going to be with you next year, which means next year you don't see 100 clients, you see 90 new clients, plus the 10 people from last year, plus a new 10 who you're not successful with this year. Over the course of 5 or 6 years, you get to the point where the majority of the clients that you're seeing are people that you're not actually achieving very much with. And we do see therapists who, at that sort of 5, 6, 7 year mark in a particular practice, they've accumulated this kind of net of clients who they're not helping and are actually just contributing to their burnout and their professional dissatisfaction. And actually, sometimes being compassionate means having the tough conversation and thinking about, am I the right therapist for this person at this time?
No, I appreciate all of that. There is a tendency coming from somewhere within us, some sort of sense of rescuing or fixing or and we hold on sometimes to a client when, coming from a kind of a compassionate motivation, but maybe there's a piece of self-awareness there that we're needing to kind of recognize. Actually, I might not be the best or right person for this particular client. I might need to go and call the lifesaver to go in and sort of, bring them into shore. Maybe it's just in this moment or this person or this kind of particular situation, but it's a kind of a self-awareness, a sort of a wisdom strength within the therapist to be able to, kind of swallow hard and sort of think about what actually is the most compassionate thing to do here.
I think it's really easy to kind of blame therapists that, it's an ego-driven thing and not willing to, step aside and admit that someone might be better. My experience has nearly always been that it's coming from a good place. It's, the therapist doesn't want to abandon the client, doesn't want to let them down. But just because something's coming from a good place, it doesn't mean that it leads to a good outcome. Because someone who sees you for 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, just ends up feeling increasingly hopeless and helpless about themselves and their own prognosis and their own mental health journey.
I'm hoping to interview Professor Stephen Rolnick soon.
Fantastic.
It hasn't been fully set in stone yet, but Steve, if you're out there, I'm looking forward to speaking with you too. Because yeah, well, as you know, Steve Rolnick is part of the Miller and Rolnick, the motivational interviewing sort of co-developers. And I'm not sure if this is a term he coined or he was sort of discussing the notion of harmology, which is what is it that causes harm? And there are certain obvious sort of harmful behaviors by people in the world and in society, but sometimes, not only might we be ineffective, but we might actually cause harm. I suppose, we might do things that, with again a compassionate motivation, but that
Absolutely.
are harmful or toxic or, kind of actually taking the person in a very difficult direction. Do you have any thoughts about that? Beyond ineffectiveness and perhaps towards something that could be harmful?
Yeah, look, I think that there's a really great for me, the person who really kicked off this thinking, maybe for the field, but certainly for me, was a guy called Scott Lilienfeld. And Lilienfeld, I think I'm trying to remember the exact name of the paper, but it was a list of potentially harmful psychotherapies. So he identified five or six different approaches to psychotherapy that, at least on the face of it, looked like they harmed more people than they actually hurt. Lilienfeld unfortunately died young, but I saw a number of his students and colleagues recently put out like a 10-year anniversary paper where they'd actually gone and done the meta-analyses and codified his potentially harmful list into an actually harmful list of different models of psychotherapy. So I think we certainly need to be aware, because I know any of the models of psychotherapy on that list, none of the people who are practicing them are doing it because they're bad people. No one's trying to harm people. They're working with difficult populations who they're trying things that are innovative and creative, and they're trying to be helpful. But I think as a starting point, we need to know the therapies that are on that list. But also, I think going further than that, we need to recognize that as therapists, all of us are going to have people who not only don't get better, but sometimes get worse over the course of therapy. Sometimes that's our fault. Sometimes it's therapy's fault. Sometimes it has nothing to do with therapy or us. But again, I think we always need to be open to the hypothesis that not only are we not helping this person, but that we are actively harming the person, or that therapy itself is actively harming the person. And often, when that is happening, the only way that we can be aware of that and have it brought to our attention is by having the outcome data that's sitting there. Because often, clients, even when they're being harmed, they say things about how they value the relationship. They think they're getting something out of therapy. They often make ego-preserving excuses for us. That make it hard for us to realize that maybe therapy is not helping them. So yeah, I think the data can just give us, again, I wouldn't suggest that data replaces clinical judgment or client preference, but the data can be another piece of information that lets us think about that issue of client harm.
Yes, clients may begin to suffer more or to experience more distress because of even just things in their own lives or things that happen and so on. But we do want to try to stop and think, is it something in the therapy that I'm using that perhaps
Absolutely.
is having an effect, like a harmful effect? Or is it something in my therapist's approach or skills that might be causing that same sort of thing? Which, like you say, it loops back again to just that importance of outcome measuring and session feedback, that's the thing that'll give us the clue, I suppose, if this is happening.
Absolutely. Therapy's not inert. Like, just sitting with a person and whether you're telling them all about the deepest thoughts and feelings you have right now, or the deepest and darkest things that have happened to you over the course of your life, we sort of have this almost post-Freudian myth that that's good for everybody. And it's not universally beneficial. So yeah, we do need to be open to the fact that not everyone benefits from therapy, and actually the process of therapy for some people is harmful.
Now, one of the things that I think I had to work through absolutely myself, early on, adopting a kind of a more feedback informed approach and so on. But often for therapists to confront the data, to get to sort of be faced with the reality of, is my client improving? Are they not improving? Are they getting worse? To also be faced with, this direct feedback from clients about, kind of, for example, on a scale of 0 to 10, how well are you feeling heard and understood? And, they give you a 5 or something, like it's a little bit confronting. And the dropout thing as well. So, I mean, I notice sometimes it's a kind of a clinician shame almost process that can arise there, that this sense of, inadequacy, inferiority, I'm not good enough, I'm not as good as the person in the next room, and all of those feelings can come flooding in. So what are your thoughts about that? How does especially an early career clinician kind of navigate some of those feelings? Does self-compassion play a role perhaps in that?
Yeah, look, I think that's such an astute point, Stan. A lot of, to me at least, a lot of the barrier to people doing this work is that it is ego confronting. And I think regardless of what internal acrobatics you have to do to make that okay, you've got to do those internal acrobatics. So this is one of those things where we might use different languages for the same thing. You might think in terms of, self-compassion and embracing a stance of self-compassion and being open to the fact that your data is not as good as you need it to be, or as you want it to be. A cognitive person might think about it in terms of not being absolute in these things and thinking about there being a spectrum of what is a good dropout rate, what's a poor dropout rate, where do you sit on that spectrum? Not viewing yourself in a completely catastrophic lens. For me at least, the internal acrobatics that I find helpful are around that idea of growth mindset, that whether I'm a good therapist or not is not a fixed characteristic. I'm not a fundamentally gifted or talentless therapist in the same way that I'm not a fundamentally gifted or talented guitarist or cricket player or weightlifter or parent for that matter. To do any of the things that I value, you've got to put the time and the work into it. So for me, when I see that data, the way that I find that self-compassion is to kind of look at the idea that it's a process. If my data is not as good as I want it to be, then the question is, how much work am I willing to put into improving it? And doing the work and coming up with systems and processes to actually get those outcomes improved.
It's a classic example, in a way, of what we might say with self-compassion, which is that self-compassion isn't necessarily just doing what makes you feel good or feel better. It's doing what's good for you, and in this case, it's doing what's good for your client, in a way, as well.
Absolutely.
And that's
Yeah.
sometimes one of the fears or the blocks around self-compassion, is that concern that it's just self-indulgent, or kind of letting us off the hook or something like that. But
Absolutely.
by the sounds of it, for you, if I'm thinking self-compassion and you're thinking growth mindset, either way, it's really about having the courage to sort of
Absolutely.
improve.
Absolutely. Because you only improve by accepting that your performance is not where you want it to be. And that's right across the field of human endeavors. It doesn't matter what you're trying to do. You have to identify that you're not where you want to be in order to improve.
A sports person, an artist, a
Musician.
musician, a restaurateur, and
Yeah.
therapists need
And
to
therapist.
be able to do it.
We can all get better at the thing if we want to. if we're willing to put the work in.
So that brings me to kind of the penultimate question. I will ask you about how people can be in touch in a moment, but yeah, so if you had an early career therapist that you're working with, and I know that you do a lot of that sort of work, and someone who's very compassionate and sort of has a strong compassionate motivation towards their clients and really wanting to be helpful. What would be, like some tips, three tips, a couple of tips or something like that you might sort of give someone like that so that they can really embody that compassion and that compassionate motivation and be effective at creating impact for their clients?
Look, that's great. I think the starting point for me is look at your clients, look at yourself, look at your business. And both for your clients, yourself, and your business, for most people, the number one thing that is going to be doing you harm is dropout rate. So I would really encourage everybody to calculate their dropout rate. And you don't need any special software to do that. You don't need to invest in Fit. You don't need to do any of that. You can just identify what your dropout rate is. And if it's above that 30% mark, I think that's the number one place that you can really make a difference for your clients, make a difference for yourself, and make a difference for your business and your practice. So that would be kind of my number one place. And then my number two place, I often find therapists and myself included, we often kind of veer wildly between moments of neuroticism and anxiety and then moments of omniscient narcissism. And I think it can be really helpful to ground ourselves in the reality. So I would say look at the data and don't feel like you're the greatest therapist in the world because you've had the last three clients of that day have all said so to you. Similarly, don't feel like you're the worst therapist in the world because the last three clients of the day have all dropped out or walked out in a somewhat dissatisfied fashion. Look at the data, but for most people, the data alone is not strong enough to overcome the anecdotal strong or negative feeling in your mouth from that client experience. So I'd say work with a supervisor who you trust and that you feel that you're safe to be vulnerable, to feel exposed, to show off the worst work that you're doing, and to not feel judged for that. I think that would be my next tip is look at the data, but look at the data with someone who's going to help you ground yourself in that data rather than just, spiral into misery if your data is not where you want it to be, or feel, overly inflated sense of superiority if your data is better than you expected.
Well, you were polite enough not to ask me earlier in this conversation, but I think I was first registered in 1993, so it's kind of 31 years, and I still find that I can, jump in the car at the end of a busy day and feel as good or not good as that last person I saw, depending. And
Absolutely.
it's tough. It's tricky to manage those feelings. We all like to be liked and approved of, and so yeah, trying to not only give attention to the data, but with support from a supervisor, someone
Absolutely.
who's able to help ground you.
Yeah. No, I think that's essential.
Well, I know that you do some wonderful work. I'm going to include all of these various links. You do a lot of supervisor training, and you also do a lot of help with helping early career and in Australia here, clinical psychology registrars to sort of get those first few years, under their belt. And that sort of thing. If people are wanting to be in touch or engage with your work, how can they find you?
Yeah, honestly, I think the Benchmark Steps website is probably the starting point at the moment, which is benchmarksteps.com. And Benchmark Steps, I guess the idea is that it's support for people at all of the different steps of their career, ranging from the registrar step, where we have the PREP program, which is the Psychology Registrar Endorsement Program. That next step, as you move into mid-career, and become a supervisor, where we have the STAP program, which is the Supervisor Training and Approval Program. And then the next step, which for a lot of people is starting their own practice and going off and, learning how to do the financials, how to do the clinical governance, how to do the HR, how to do the legals, where myself and Kay Frankham offer a number of training products around the Creating Impact book, but also around the work that she's done in supporting practice owners too. So that Benchmark Steps website, kind of that's the umbrella that holds all of those things, as well as you can obviously follow me on LinkedIn or Facebook, and I put occasional provocative things up there every now and then when I have the time or inspiration to do so.
Yes, if you hadn't mentioned those, I was going to throw those in as well. There's some great stuff that you very well, very thoughtful stuff that you post on LinkedIn and Facebook. So I will include those links as well. But yes, Dr. Aaron Frost, thank you very much for coming on Compassion in a T-shirt.
Thanks, Dan. It's been a pleasure. You take care.
Thank you.